I want to take you back to some of the sounds I played for you at the top of the programme. I want you now to just take a moment and relax. Relax wherever you happen to be. Be careful if you're driving a car or operating heavy machinery, and enjoy these wonderful natural sounds. Those sounds, those vocalizations, are taken from an album called Songs of the Humpback Whale. It was released in 1970 and produced by Roger Payne, the marine biologist who died recently. I mentioned him at the top of the program. He was famous for his 1967 discovery of whale song among humpback whales, and later became an important figure in the worldwide campaign to end commercial whaling. Friend, filmmaker and author of How to Speak Whale, Tom Mustell, said that Roger totally changed our perception of these animals that we were slaughtering. In this audio clip, Roger explains to Tom Mustell how we should listen to whale song.
For people who are going to listen to whale song now,
yeah,
how should you listen to whale song?
Attentively. You should listen silently. You should listen with nothing else to distract you. That's the way to listen.
It's making the hair stand up on the back of my neck, I have to say. Anyway, let's say hello now to Tom Mustell, who joins us from his home in London. Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Hello, Derek. I'm very well, thank you. Lovely to join you today.
Now, tell us about your association with Roger Payne.
Well, I met him in 2018 when I was making a film about humpback whales. And we sort of really became very good friends. And he was almost sort of like a mentor to me. And we've stayed in close contact ever since. And I wrote a book called How to Speak Whale, which is about his life story and other whale scientists. And it's about how understanding animal communications helps us to empathize with them, and that has really big impacts on how we can conserve them.
And what would you say was Roger's contribution to conservation, and in particular whales, and how much of an impact did this discovery of whale song have on people?
He contributed in sort of three very distinct ways. I think one was scientifically. He with his collaborator Scott McVeigh and his wife Katie Payne, he proved that the recordings of humpback whales that were given to him by a Navy engineer who'd recorded them in the 50s and 60s were actually song, that if you analysed them, they had repeated patterns in them, rhythm and rhyme, and small subunits that were broken up and put together in verse, chorus, verse style configurations. And by proving that, he got the front cover of the journal Science. And really, that was a great shock for the scientific community to think that these animals, whales, which nobody really gave much thought to and were being industrially slaughtered, might be capable of something that we thought really only humans and some birds could do. But the second thing he did was he was always an enormous believer in emotion over data. His whole life really was about that. The data was very useful, but all the great events in human history have been shaped by emotion. And he realized when he listened to the music, he and Katie cried. They thought it was so beautiful. And that he knew that if he played the songs of the whales to other people, this, more than their analytical discovery, would affect people and the way they thought about whales. And it did. It was absolutely huge. It's hard to really imagine now, but when they released these songs, Roger released an album, Songs of the Humpback Whale, that Bob Dylan played at concerts, and Judy Collins sang along and accompanied on her albums, the folk singer. There were listening parties all around the world. Carl Sagan put the recordings on the Voyager space probe, so they're now in interstellar space. Nat Geo, the National Geographic magazine, put the recordings on a flexi disc and sent them out to all 10.5 million subscribers. So it was the biggest album pressing of any musical album of all time. And sort of Whale Song just went viral. And this enormously galvanized the Save the Whales environmental movement, because suddenly people could hear their voices and suddenly people cared. And that not only led to the moratorium on commercial whaling, where all the countries around the world, well, almost all of them, agreed to stop whaling, at least for a while, which certainly stopped many species of whale from heading to certain extinction. But it also was the first success story in conservation in the environmental movement. And Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace and other organizations sprang from this. And it was something we could point to show that when people cared about something, we could change. And the third and final thing he did for conservation was really, he was just a wonderful encourager of other people. And anywhere you go in biology, especially marine biology, you'll come across people who met him. And despite the fact he got a MacArthur Genius Fellowship and all these grand titles and awards and was so accomplished, he always gave you his absolute full attention. And if you were enthusiastic about something, he would help you and encourage you and make you feel like anything was possible.
He was a very humble man, at least came across that way. He certainly wore his learning lightly, let's say.
He really was. He was not interested in any way in pomp or hierarchy or rank. He was just great fun to be around. All my memories of him are of curiosity and laughter and music and ice cream. He absolutely loved desserts. And so I've never seen someone get so excited about, even when he was 88, you know, just at the very end of his life, if Lisa, his wife, gave him some ice cream, he would be like a tiny, excited child. You never got any feeling of being intimidated, which meant that I think people were very open with him in return. Yeah, he's just a great guy.
Richard.
Tom, it has been argued that in humans, voice calls and shouts and things like that predated the development of language. They act as triggers. In other words, if you shout, look out, help, or I'm in trouble, or whatever, mayday, you will get an immediate response. Now, it isn't that the person who hears it conceptualizes it and sort of works out, oh, this fellow's in trouble, what am I going to do? That sort of thing. But the second stage of communication means that the receiver, the person, and the animal receiving the signal has to kind of construct and model or what is going on and make decisions. That's the sort of thing we do. Now, the whales, 30-minute song about the humpback, for instance, is it simply a trigger that produces a reaction in the muscles of other whales, or does the whale derive information from that he interiorizes, builds a theory, reflects on, and makes a decision? Is that the model, and did Roger Payne advocate that view?
Well, it's a very good question. I think it's very important when thinking about the vocalizations that the 90-odd species of cetaceans make, of which humpback whales and their song is just a small fraction. A distinction between song, well, what we call song, which are these, what we call performances of that it seems that the males do, compared to all the other vocalizations that they make. For instance, when they're coordinating hunting behavior together, like bubble net feeding, where different whales have different roles and they seem to use their vocalizations to initiate when they start breathing out underwater and when they lunge in and things like that. For humpback whale song, we still do not know its function. With the example you gave, where if you give an immediate, quick, loud shout, it doesn't necessarily need to have meaning, as in a word with meaning like fire, you could just shout in a scared way and other humans would give it attention and be able to infer things about you without a meaningful word being shouted. But these whales sing for sometimes over 24 hours and their songs evolve every year as they listen to each other's calls. And they sing in every sea in the world, and they've been doing it for longer, it's thought, than humans have been communicating with language on land. So it would seem a very complicated and long-winded and energetically expensive way of just saying something very simple, if it is something very simple being broadcast, to be interpreted like, say, their body size or their mating readiness. Katie Rogers' wife, she believes that the reason the whales migrate to the tropics and to particular sites to sing, where they do most of their singing, though we now know that they actually sing all over the place, even in their feeding grounds, is because of the underwater acoustics, and that she thinks that they might choose them for their acoustical properties. But what is encoded in that song, if there is anything meaningful there, who knows? I mean, one thing that Katie did find was that they seem to employ rhyme and rhythm in their songs. And in human epic poetry and long human songs, rhyme and rhythm are ways that we can both cue in and remember things, but also remember from the performers very complicated long patterns, like in epic poems. So really, we don't know, because they are so long, so little studied and so complex, even 50 years later, what they might represent.
Was it she that discovered or pointed out that in the breeding season, the whales move to fairly shallow waters, 20 to 40 metres deep, with smooth bottoms, so that the sound carries best? There are no obstacles. So this would seem to chime with what you are saying there, that this is a way they go about things. It isn't just arbitrary. They have a definite reason to go to the places they go to breed. Is that true?
Well, the whales go to those breeding grounds for a number of reasons. The female whales go there, it's thought, because this is with humpback whales, because other species have different breeding mechanisms. They go because the waters are warmer, and the young whales, before they go to the colder waters when they're born, they need to feed up and gain lots of fatty blubber to insulate themselves. Whales also move to those warmer waters a bit like a spa. If you look at a blue whale before it's done its warm water migration, actually it won't look blue. The surface will be sort of greeny tinged, because their skin becomes home to a whole ecosystem of parasites and hangers-on, like barnacles and sort of microscopic organisms. And by travelling from the cold to the hot, they basically cook them off and they shed them. So there's a health benefit to those migrations as well. And they go there because there are fewer predators, so they're safer. In many large vertebrates, there are population dynamics where females will go to places to give birth or to feed, and males will follow those females. And it seems maybe like that's what's kind of happening with the humpbacks too. But the more we look at these whales, the more we realise how much more complicated this picture is, because we found whales that are singing in feeding grounds. We've found whales that are singing on their migration corridors. We've heard fragments of what we would previously call a whale song, but seem to be being vocalised in non-song behaviour settings. And what I mean by that is, I've filmed whales singing, and they will hang motionless by themselves. I filmed them in the Dominican Republic, about 20 metres below the surface, and they'll sing for 25 minutes or so, then come up to the surface and breathe, and then go down and repeat exactly the same song. You start to recognise different refrains and patterns in it if you're listening. And it's an extraordinary thing to feel, because your whole body resonates with this song. And often there'll be another whale nearby, not close, and it will often be another male paying attention. So maybe the males are listening to each other to pick up, to learn. We know in zebra finches, young zebra finches learn from older male, what are called tutors, their songs. And in humpbacks, because the songs are very varied at the beginning of the breeding season, but over the breeding season, as they all listen to one another, they all end up singing the same song, that year's song. It does appear that they're paying very close attention to each other. But the females don't really seem to care. When you watch the females, they're not coming over and looking at the male singers, which is confusing, because in birds, often the males are singing in order to, or at least in many male birdsong context, to demonstrate their fitness or to show the females that they, you know, that they should mate with them. Though again, in birds, it's all being turned upside down with recent discoveries about female birdsong, and that looking in all of the branches of the bird family tree, there seem to be female singers too. So ancestrally, maybe song in birds and whales is not just something males do to show off to females. Maybe like shouting or singing in humans, it could have many different functions depending on what's useful and the context.
You use the word function there. Are we humans too preoccupied with purpose and function and achieving certain ends? If you go down to the pub, you go down just to, as they say, chill out. You're not looking to change the world or change people's opinions or to find out an awful lot. You just want to relax and let your hair down. Could the whales have this component as well? They're not actually hoping to improve their mating chances or whatever, but just to take it easy and relax and let it all hang out. Is that a possible mode of behaviour? I remember there an interesting thing I read somewhere about the pilot whales, that they have something like 7 or 8 types of whistle. And you see the bold statement that 2 of those whistles are expressions of mood. Now, this is a very, very tricky one. When you go to the pub, you express mood. I'm a bit down. Things haven't gone well in the office. I'm quarrelling with a wife or whatever it is. Is there anything like that going on in whales?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many fascinating questions in the range just then. Well, in terms of like, yeah, this very brutal and very boring way that we have at the moment in or have had for a long time in biology of trying to look for function in everything, I think you make a really good point, because whales have been on top of the food chain, apex predators, for millions and millions of years. And we do loads of things that aren't every day vital to our survival, but yet are very pleasurable and important to us. And we have free time. We're not constantly hunting and scavenging or making shelter or migrating. And if you look at cetaceans, the whales and dolphins, they do lots of things that don't seem to have a very clear functional explanation. Bow riding by dolphins, where if you go on a boat in the sea and you're traveling and you're making way at a reasonable speed, often dolphins will come from the horizon to ride the wave in front of the boat. It might not be going in the direction that they were planning on going. Dolphins surf. They pass around pufferfish and intoxicate themselves intentionally. With Diana Reiss's cognition experiments, when she placed mirrors in front of dolphins to see if they were self-conscious, if they could understand that they were seeing themselves in the mirrors, they not only passed this mirror recognition test, as it's called, they could see the dots on their bodies that she'd drawn, showing that they knew that it was their bodies in the mirror, but they stuck their mouths open and waggled their tongues around, and they had sex in front of the mirrors and did all sorts of quite identifiable things that you think maybe people might do if they'd never come across mirror. I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating on what people might do, but they seem to do lots of things for fun and the pleasure of it. And I think in our relentless search for constantly trying to show why every action an animal does is justified by its evolutionary fitness, we might be missing out on a bigger picture. But then in your example of going down to the pub, you might not know why going down to the pub feels nice, and you might not be thinking, I'm going to go down and increase my evolutionary fitness. But studies of human longevity show that one of the most important things for our life expectancy is socializing and the renewal and experience of social connection. You know, so if that's one of the things that can make us live long, happy lives with healthy bodies, you know, then there is a function there too, even if we don't know why we're driven to do it. But there's a chicken and egg thing. Does the function come from the pleasure and the wellness of the activity, or does it drive us to seek it out, or is it an interplay? And you know what? And your last question about the vocalizations of pilot whales. The way we've been breaking down their vocalizations, all cetaceans so far, has been so crude that we just look for what seem to be the beginnings and the ends of their signals. But with research into sperm whales now, they've been finding that what they thought were just 30-odd different signals are actually potentially hundreds of signals. But we've just been too crude in where the differences that we saw between the signals that they were making, and that these signals might represent and have meaning. And I mean that, like, genuinely have meaning. That's what the research underway is looking into. That changes depending on the population and their context, what they're doing, and the culture of those whales. You know, for instance, there's very good supporting evidence that there are signature whistles, which are sort of dolphin, and there are other species of toothed whale that develop over the first years of their life a unique whistle that seems to be their identifier, that is used by them to signal that they are present, and other dolphins to signal when they've noticed them being there, like a name. But they also seem to have group signature whistles, like a signal that represents their social group or cluster. And these are the easiest signals to spot because you can notice when one dolphin uses a whistle that it never uses and that the other dolphins don't use when it's not around. But how would you try and get a window into whether the other communications are meaningful when we've only really been watching the wild lives of these animals for a few decades? We've never seen them in their totality, so we don't know what they might be trying to communicate. And we've always been looking so crudely that we've actually been sort of labelling what could be hundreds and hundreds of different signals as just a dozen or so.
You know the distinction between what they call handicap displays and revealing displays. In the handicap display, you expend energy and resources making the display. The peacock's tail is a great example. In the revealing display, you don't. You just show what is there by flashing your whatever it is you have to offer and not depleting it in doing so. Now, in whales, it seems to me, the whole thing must be a handicapped display that's going on. You look at the sperm whale with his huge bulbous head, and that isn't there for nothing. It's all there to send out pulses and time those pulses from reflections in the head and so on and so forth and so on. Now, is it true then that whales are investing an enormous amount of resources in this communication thing, and not they have to, and there's no choice in the matter? Well, how would you view this kind of notion?
There's probably a big mixture of things going on at once. Like sperm whales, as you mentioned, have these gigantic, I mean, a third to a quarter of their body mass is taken up with this, the front, which is essentially whales used to live on land. Like us, about 55 million years ago, they had terrestrial ancestors, they're mammals, and they were sort of little doggy, hooved-like animals, and they moved into the sea. And they, when they did so, their noses kind of folded up and contorted on the front of their heads, and the toothed whales, this is, like sperm whales, killer whales, dolphins. You see these big bulges on the front, what's called the melon, or the spermaceti organ in the sperm whale. It's unclear how it evolved first, but in the sea, you can't see very well. The light doesn't penetrate very far. There's turbulence. It's so hard to see through the water. So if you're a social animal that needs to coordinate, or if you're a predator that needs to hunt, you need to be able to perceive what's happening in the water around you. Fish do this by picking up, or some kinds of fish, on the pressure changes as other animals move around, and they feel these in little pits along their body, or they can sense electromagnetic forces from life. But the whale ancestors, what they did was they developed excellent hearing and echolocation. This is in the toothed whales. So those big bulges in the front of their head, they used to create clicks and send them out, and then, like bats, listen for the echoes. And Roger's mentor actually coined the term echolocation, and Roger Payne's early work was in bats and echolocation in the air. So you could say that it's just a navigation organ, but what's unclear is, it then became very functional also for communication, because if you devote a huge part of your body to making sound and listening to sound, and the whales or many whale species have more neuronal receptors in their inner ear than we do, so they're very good at picking up sound waves. They pick up the sound waves not using pinna, outer ears like us, but using fatty filled channels that run up through their jaws like a giant radar dish. And they process these in large, big, convoluted parts of their brains. So the receiving and sending out of sound is very, very helpful and very, very developed in them. They have higher hearing ranges and they have a wider frequency mode of voices. They're virtuoso. So it might have been developed just for trying to find food and survive, but they have developed it into something else, which is incredibly sophisticated communication. And that's why, to bring it back to the first point you made about signalling and handicaps, the male sperm whales have much bigger noses than the females. So there's sexual dimorphism. And that isn't because the males need to eat more food and make more signals. It's because they also signal their size using these clicks they make, which are the loudest sounds that any animal has ever made, we think. And I've swum and filmed with these sperm whales and I felt it go through my body like being hit in the chest with a ruler. So it's a really complicated space where you have these animals that moved into the sea from the land, they developed this novel and extremely effective way of seeing through the water using sound pulses. But they've also developed that to be able to make lots of other kinds of sounds and communicate with each other. Because they're social animals, and many of the species are, they need to be able to coordinate with each other. The scientists who study sperm whales, like Hal Whitehead and Luke Rendell, they've been studying them for 40 years. They describe the sperm whales as having unique cultures, where animals that look the same to us from outside actually have totally different ways of communicating with each other, and they have totally different accents and vocal clans. So you can tell the whales apart by the way they, inverted commas, speak. And these seem to represent also differences in how they hunt. They teach each other how to defend themselves, how to forage, how to creche their young, how to look after their disabled and their elderly, how to migrate, how to move when there's new threats and new water systems. Like with climate change, it's threatening their existing food supplies because of current changes. All of these things they learn to do by using their voices and passing on information, it seems, in their voices, which differ between them to each other, using these giant organs that they evolved to be able to move in the sea and to look around in it. But there's also a sexual element where if you have developed an incredibly impressive voice, and that's a really useful thing, then maybe demonstrating that by, if you're a male that wants to seduce females by expressing yourself very loudly in it, is also a benefit. So all of these different evolutionary and environmental and behavioural functions are sort of wrapped up together in a sort of knot that it's quite hard to untangle and say it's just for this, it's just for that.
Tom, can you tell us a little about the Dominica Sperm Whale Project?
There's 35 different scientists, linguists, philosophers, machine learning experts, behaviourists, animal biologists, engineers, roboticists, ethologists, people from all branches of engineering, marine physics, human language and animal behaviour. And they are trying to get the biggest data set ever of the sperm whales there, because we've never actually got lots and lots of animal conversations, if conversations is what they are. We've just decided what they do based on not actually recording them and analysing it, because we haven't been able to. But they've set up a giant listening station in the sea. It's already recorded more than twice the amount of all sperm whale vocal interactions ever recorded before. And they're going to use something that doesn't have human bias to try to map out the patterns in those communications and see if they're language-like. And that's the tools behind Google Translate. Google Translate can translate between Urdu and English and Spanish without being told how those languages work, or even that it is dealing with a language. If you get huge, big data sets and you put them into these large language models, they can map out the relationships between all the words, if that's what you want, or all the sentences, all the other different linguistic structures in a language, and then compare the interrelations of all of those between languages. And what those tools have found is you can translate between English and Urdu and Spanish just by asking the machine learning tool to find the same pattern in one language and another. So you can translate between them without using a bilingual dictionary. So they're going to try and see if these tools that can find hidden patterns in huge data sets of human language could find hidden patterns in huge data sets of non-human communications. And not to have arrogance, I should say, the people leading these projects, like David Gruber, they don't presume we might understand what it is they're communicating, but they want to just go and look and see what's there and see how we fit into it and if there's overlap or not. Because perhaps there's no way we could ever understand the world of a whale, its umwelt, the way it perceives and lives, because they're so different. But perhaps there is a way we could, because we share ancestors, they're our relatives, they're mammals, they give birth to live young, which they suckle, they seem to show signs of mourning, they have to forage, they have to come to the surface to breathe. We have a lot of things in common. They live long lives, some of them live 200 years, many of the big whales live about a human lifespan. They seem to have about a similar number of offspring that they seem to take care of in similar ways that we do. So with this similar evolutionary background, the same origin of our nervous systems and our hormonal systems and our perception systems, very similar brain anatomies, it seems, with some differences, and similar life challenges, it would be very interesting to see where the differences in how they vocalize and communicate and coordinate and represent their lives are. I think that's the thing. It's not, will we crack the code so we can talk to them? It's, can we finally give them some proper scientific attention to see the nature of their communication systems that give us windows into their worlds? And if those windows help us to empathize with them more and understand their challenges, then that will give us opportunities to protect them. Because really, these may be the only other conscious, sentient, communicating animals in the universe. And we almost made them extinct Roger's lifetime ago. We could still make them extinct now, but perhaps we could also talk to them. And that seems to me, in an age of billions and billions being spent on looking for subatomic particles or new space telescopes, a very urgent thing to do. I would take that money and I would put it onto looking at the lives of other species, because subatomic particles aren't going extinct and neither are distant supernovae.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That was fascinating.